Welcome to Crash Concepts, where the economy, energy, and the environment are explored. Up next, fresh ideas and insights into the factors that are driving the world and shaping your future. Presenting information you can't afford to live without, here's Chris Martinson.
Welcome to Peak Prosperity. I am your host, Chris Martinson, and today we have the pleasure of speaking with Joel Salatin, one of the most visible and influential leaders in the organic food and sustainable farming movement. His family owns and manages Polyface Farms, which has featured prominently in such modern food movement masterworks as The Omnivore's Dilemma by Michael Pollan and the documentary film Food, Inc. He is America's resident farmer philosopher. We last spoke to Joel in 2011, and that podcast was very well received, widely listened to, sparked numerous excellent conversations. Joel's unconventional but highly innovative farming practices are inspiring millions to increase their nutritional and community resiliency by seeking out local sources of chemical-free food raised using natural process-based farming practices. Joel, welcome back.
Thank you, Chris. Great to be with you.
Well, today I want to cover a million things, and Joel, I know you are up to that task, but in case we can't get to them all, my main priorities are to discuss the intersection of modern farming and the current drought in the U.S., what people can do about increasing their food resilience in their local communities, if not yards, what sorts of bright spots you can share with us from your speaking and travels, and what we should be doing individually, nationally, maybe even globally, to prepare for a more durable future. Is that a decent lineup?
Well, that sounds like, well, that's just the first 5 minutes. Then what are we going to do?
I don't know. I'll think of something. Well, let's start with the drought. First, this is being compared to the droughts of 1988 and 1956. And so I guess these sorts of things do happen. But in your view, what are the main issues that are being exposed by this particular drought?
Well, that's a great question. First of all, hydrology and hydration. The big pick, there are several things. There are several vulnerabilities that are coming out. And anybody who knows me knows that I'm a big believer in ecological participation. I am not a big believer in environmentalism by abandonment. That is mm-hmm. unfortunately kind of the mantra of the radical environmental fringe, which believes that, you know, the best environmental policy is one of human abandonment.
Mm-hmm.
So I look in the mirror and say, well, why do I have this big brain and these, you know, opposing thumbs, and say, so what am I here for? And what I'm here for is to participate in the environment as an active player to massage this ecological womb into more forgiveness. How do you build a forgiving landscape, a forgiving system? So, first of all, it's important to realize that perennials are far more forgiving than annuals. Perennials, you know, live year to year, don't have to be planted. You don't need the moisture to grow the seed. They're much more resilient from year to year than annuals.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, U.S. farm policy is all about annuals, not perennials. And perennials can be anything from nut trees to, you know, to vineyards to, obviously, my, you know, big deal is grasses, perennial grasses, the perennial
mm-hmm.
prairies. And those are far more resilient under stress than our corn and soybeans and small grains and annuals, even, you know, for that matter, even vegetables.
Mm-hmm.
So the first thing is to return to a perennially based system rather than an annual-based system. You know, the U.S. even subsidizes annuals in production, which creates an inordinate pricing structure and masks many of the weaknesses over time of the annual-type production. So what that means is that cattle need to be taken out of feedlots. They need to be put on perennial prairie polycultures. But we're not talking about, you know, 200-year-ago infrastructure. We're talking about using, you know, computer microchipped electric fencing, polyethylene black plastic pipe watering systems. You know, we can actually mimic the kind of production that was here 600 years ago even better than it was then. In fact, there were more pounds of red meat in what is now the U.S. 500 years ago than there are today, even with all the annuals and all the petroleum fertilizer, because the perennials were so voluminous and so resilient.
Mm-hmm.
Number one. Number two is hydration. See, one of our problems in our culture is that we were colonized. You know, you could Native Americans would say taken over. But anyway, the fact is that our culture is based in European culture. And when you look at Great Britain, Scotland, Ireland, places like that, their water, when you talk about water there, it's all about drainage. You know, we got to drain it. Here, the problem is not drainage, it's hydration. How do you hydrate the landscape? And this is true, I mean, sure, there are a few places where drainage is an issue, but for the most part, certainly in the lion's share of the continent, hydration is the bigger issue. So how do you hydrate this? And I would suggest that the number one way is to build farm ponds, not Army Corps of Engineer dams and not, you know, Tennessee Valley Authority dams or whatever. What I'm talking about are millions and millions and millions of farm ponds. If the amount of earth that was moved today to move soil and till it to grow annuals were focused instead on moving soil to build farm ponds, keep the raindrops as high on the landscape as possible for as long as possible, we would fundamentally alter the hydration, the base flow, the aquifers, the whole situation in the country. The problem is that between burning out the organic matter, and that brings me to the third point, I mean, we don't have, you go to Australia, even in an urban setting, every house has a couple 1,500-gallon cisterns under the gutter downspout.
Mm-hmm.
Goodness, in Colorado, it's illegal to have a rain barrel. That's how nuts we are in this country. You know, we have to really focus attention on keeping water as high on the landscape as possible for as long as possible. And the third thing is that with chemical fertilization and tillage, we have taken the organic matter out of our soils. Organic, 1 pound of organic matter holds 4 pounds of water. So when we burn out the organic matter with either tillage or with chemical fertilizer, which stings the soil life and makes it start to cannibalize the soil life to stay alive, when that happens, then the water retentive capacity of the landscape fundamentally changes. One of the reasons that the Mississippi floods so dramatically, so frequently in recent decades is because the organic matter of all of the area feeding the Mississippi River is down by about, you know, 4 times. In other words, it's gone from like an average of 6 or 7% organic matter down to, in some cases, 1% organic matter, you know, in the last 70 or 80 years. That actually creates a huge loss of water retention in the landscape.
So that it's as if billions of sponges suddenly cried out and were silenced.
Yes, yes, absolutely. That's exactly the way that, because organic matter, you know, is like compost. It's real soft and resilient and spongy. And when you take that sponginess out, not only can the soil, when it does rain, it can't absorb the water as fast, but it also can't hold as much. So you're working against yourself both directions. Whereas in the prairie, the native prairie, where the organic matter was very high and there was this tremendous carpet of thick vegetation on the soil surface, it protected the soil both from erosion and from organic matter burnout. And, of course, you know, the roots and the biomass are what fed the soil, which, you know, didn't burn out the organic matter. So, in fact, it actually built the organic matter. And so you take those, you know, those three elements, the annuals, the lack of hydration, and the chemical fertilization, and you've got, you know, 3 strikes and you're out. So you know, a lot of people, even conservatives, are looking at this and saying, this is why we need crop insurance, you know, crop insurance to protect these farmers. Well, I think taxpayer-subsidized crop insurance simply props up this continued assault against the ecological profit and loss statement. If farmers had to actually bear the cost of assaulting nature, maybe they would begin looking at some of these, you know, some of these other parts of the equation and change some of their practices.
Right. So if I could summarize then, you're suggesting that unlike the droughts of 56 for sure, maybe even 1988, because there's been some erosion of soil quality even since then, modern agribusiness practices have then exacerbated this drought.
Yes, that is correct. And certainly, you know, 1988 We were already, you know, way down the road in the destruction that we are today. That's not that long ago. 1956, again, it was the tilling up, it was the inversion, the destruction of the prairie that fundamentally altered things. Now, there were certainly droughts, you know, long before then,
mm-hmm.
but the resiliency of the landscape and the ability of the landscape to, you know, to weather droughts was, you know, what was better. And beyond that, I would simply say that if we Europeans, with our cleverness and our machinery, if we had started day one in hydrating that landscape and building ponds,
mm-hmm.
so that the floodwaters, you know, when there was excess moisture, it didn't flood out everybody downstream, but we caught it up high in these ponds. You know, Lewis Bromfield in the 1950s, in his, you know, foundational books for the ecological farming movement, you know, Out of the Earth and Malabar Farm, and all these books, he talks about, you know, dreaming that the entire Ohio River Valley would have millions and millions of farm ponds like small cattle hoof prints up in the headwaters. And this was in the 1950s, and he said, you know, the whole notion that we can control water and floods and things by doing grandiose projects at the end of the pipe,
mm-hmm.
is stupid. You've got to control the flow at the beginning of the pipe. Man can't do anything at the end of the pipe. You got to do it at the beginning of the pipe.
Oh, well said. I certainly get that. And when I've looked at some of the farming practices in Australia, where they do key line plowing,
yeah.
and other things like that, where they have to manage aggressively for very, very low amounts of water, they found ways to subsist and farm successfully in places with 20 inches of rain or even less. And I note that in the U.S., typically our response to that is just dig a little deeper, pump from an aquifer, Yolgalala or some other place.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, think about, I don't know if you, I was just recently in New Mexico, and in fact, I was in Texas too recently. But anyway, you know, you go out through there, Arizona, New Mexico, Nevada, and you're driving down the road, and you look down, and you're driving across this bridge, this big concrete bridge that's maybe 100 feet long, and you look underneath, and there's this huge dry riverbed. You know, it's got dirt bike tracks and, you know,
uh-huh.
ATV tracks up
yep.
there. And you ask the guy that's driving the car, he said, what is this? Are these sunken paths for, you know, off-road vehicles, or, you know, what's this for? Oh, those are the arroyos. And, about 5 days a year, they completely fill up and even flood out. And so even in environments like that, if we would build ponds up in those areas, and catch all that surface runoff water, not only would we protect the people downstream, but we would actually see springs come back, trees grow, rain cycles run better, just from hydrating the landscape. Here on our farm in Shenandoah Valley, we're in a 31-inch rainfall area, and we have a significant drought event about once every 3 years. And these are significant droughts. You know, wells go dry, springs go dry, that sort of thing. And so every couple of years, every time we scrabble together another couple $1,000, we go up in the highlands here on the farm, and build another pond. You know, it might cost $4,000 or $5,000, $6,000 gets you a pretty big pond, and we build these ponds. So now, as I sit here talking to you today, we're in the middle of the summer, and we have multiple ponds that gravity feed through a network of 5 miles of polyethylene black plastic pipe that gives us 80 pounds of pressure water over the entire farm. We have millions of gallons stored up in these high swales, these high valleys that were accumulated back in the winter and kept the Potomac from being at flood stage. Obviously, you know,
mm-hmm.
this is a small amount. But the point is, if this were duplicated, instead of farmers buying silos and Monsanto seed corn, building feedlots, pouring concrete, and buying the latest truck and white picket fences, if that were the thrust instead to create forgiveness and water resiliency in the landscape, suddenly, you know, we could recreate Eden here. We would be flood-proof, drought-proof, and recreate Eden. So you know, the tragedy of the conversation is not that we're lazy, because, you know, most people aren't lazy. The tragedy is that we've invested all this time and money and energy being busy working at the wrong things.
Well, that's the lure of technology. If your first technology fails, you just go on to a better one and keep moving along. And sometimes that requires a rethinking. So you're saying that if we just rethought the hydrology, we could put ponds in. Obviously, this is something that I think is already being successfully demonstrated, practiced with enough experience under its belt. You could say it works. It's profitable.
Oh, yeah.
It's ecologically.
Oh, absolutely.
Makes sense. Yep. Financially, it makes sense. It makes sense in all sorts of dimensions. And we're not doing it because?
Well, we're not doing it. We're not doing it because it's not promoted. In fact, now the USDA discourages farm ponds because they make places for wildfowl to land on and have their babies on, and the wildfowl, of course, according to the common thought, are going to bring avian flu, which is going to destroy the planet with sick chickens. And so, you know, there's back in the 1950s, the USDA actually encouraged farmers to build ponds, and now it's actually discouraging farmers from building ponds because it's a liability instead of an asset. I mean, that's how ridiculous that, you know, our ag policy has become.
Well, I can tell you, in my own state of Massachusetts, where I'm calling you from, to touch any sort of a wetlands is a major no-no. It's a pretty stiff regulatory set of hurdles you got to leap over. And to create a pond where there hasn't been one, I'm not quite clear on that, but I would bet that involves more than one permit as well. So it's not easy.
No, that's right. That's right. We go back to the top of the conversation where I said one of the biggest, you know, problems in our culture is that we're looking at environmentalism as something that we do based on abandonment rather than participation.
Mm-hmm.
And so we've got this notion that the best thing we can do for the ecology and the environment is to abandon it, walk away, have no human footprints. And what we should have been doing with this, I'll call it the blessing of petroleum, we should have been leveraging it on these kinds of hydration projects, to run, you know, track loaders and front end loaders and things, and build these ponds and put in the piping. If we had invested in that instead of bigger plows and bigger discs and GMO grains or whatever, if we'd invested in that instead, today we would have a very, very forgiving, resilient landscape.
I agree. You know, I do believe that if humans are ignorant and just blunder around, they can actually make things worse. And I do believe some movements out there just have no faith in humans and say, let's just stop them from blundering around. But the point I love that you're making is that we also, if we're intelligent and creative, have the opportunity to enhance what nature's already doing. We can speed it up. We can create 100 years of soil in a year if we want. We can do extraordinary things, make food sheds 10 times more productive than they currently are.
Yes, absolutely. There's nothing inherently environmentally damaging about human participation. Yes, I admit, you know, repent in sackcloth and ashes for all of human, you know, devastation has been caused throughout history, and it's been caused long before the USDA, long before America, long before a lot of things. But it doesn't have to be so. In fact, you know, we are not only the most efficient at destroying it, we're also the most efficient at healing it. And that's why, you know, this program is so important to help people to understand that that we need to ratchet up our humble massage participation, and we can actually be, you know, a real healer to the landscape rather than a harm.
I love that message. It's absolutely right. So before we move on from this drought, one last question on it. Is it too early to start worrying about next year's crop? Are droughts, do they get bad enough under modern agribusiness that it goes into what I would call the subsoil down deeper, where some sort of rehydration might take a long time, or where does this become sort of an annoyance at current crop prices and become something a little bit more serious?
Well, sure. I mean, a drought cycle, you know, you get into it, and you know, we don't know where it ends. I mean, ask the people at the Sahel, you know,
right.
the Rajputan Desert in India, you know, which archaeologists have now found, you know, huge granary kind of lime, you know, precursor to concrete, huge granaries, you know, in what is today a desert, and yet climatologists have gone in there, fenced out the livestock, and in a couple of years it greens up and the rains fall, and so you know, this is not just a U.S. It's worldwide. This lack of appreciation for nature's profit and loss statement. And whether you're nomadic or whether you have property ownership or tribalism or Republican, you know, forms of government, the fact is that nature's balance sheet supersedes all of those, you know, social, political, economic systems. And so, you know, what people need to do is to realize that part of our mandate, our Creator's mandate, is to use this this creativity that we have and address it on the landscape to make the landscape more resilient. So yes, there ought to be more cisterns, there ought to be rain barrels, there ought to be home gardens, so you're not dependent on food shipped in from somewhere else. You know, all of those kinds of things that you can do for yourself to extricate yourself from the vulnerabilities of a culture gone mad with hubris is a positive thing.
Well, I have a very personal question about this resilience then. So I was very clever. 3 years ago, I put in about 26 fruit trees and nut trees. And this is all in the interest of increased food resilience and eating tree-ripened fruit. I had the whole fantasy, got it really well laid out. And this year I got a single plum from one tree. And the reason was a whole lot of early warmth that forced the earliest recorded bloom in our region on record right now, and then a regular April frost. And it suddenly occurs to me that neither of my food goals are being met this year. Is this just a case of welcome to farming 101, Chris, or does food resilience now require that I invest in, I don't know, different varieties, greenhouses, anti-frost technology? I mean, if this pattern persists, I no longer live in an area that's amenable to fruit trees.
Oh, that's a great question. You know, my quick response is welcome to farming.
Uh-huh.
You know, the fact is there's happening, and of course, to be absolutely honest, this is one of the single biggest arguments of the kind of the industrial food, you know, globalists, anti-local crowd that scoff at the notion, you know, that local food systems actually work. Here's the thing you have to understand. We haven't gotten where we are overnight, and we won't get out of it overnight. And the truth is, very possibly some of your varieties were not, you know, climatized or bioregionally adapted to your area. You got them out of, you know, nursery catalogs, whatever, you know, other places. Secondly, anomalies do happen, and that's why in old days people stocked a larder. You know, and I mean, in our case, at our house, Teresa usually keeps about 2 years worth of food canned in the pantry, you know, so when we have a bumper crop of tomatoes or plums or apples for applesauce, you know, we can it and put it by. So I think that, and I think beyond that is just variety. Typically, you don't have a complete loss. A year that's bad for plums might be good for mulberries. A year that's bad for, like this year, right? This year we're having a bumper strawberry and blackberry crop. Yeah, we had that early season too, and our apples didn't do very well, didn't do nearly as well as it did last year. But, you know, we've picked, 20 gallons of blackberries. So Teresa froze a bunch of blackberries, you know. We've had blackberry cobbler and things. Very seldom does everything go by. And, you know, fascinatingly, if you go to the early planters, you know, go to Mount Vernon, go to Monticello, Thomas Jefferson. Mount Vernon, of course, was George Washington. But you go and you look at the recipes, the larder, the index to the larder that was there. My goodness, there are all these amazing fruits, you know, quince and currant and you know, gooseberries and like around our area, up in these mountains, the old timers say the neighbors used to get together. This is before the government owned all the, you know, forest land. And they used to get together and agree to burn. They'd burn about 10 acres on the mountain every year, and that's where the whole community went and picked blueberries. They burned about 10 acres every year, and the blueberry bushes would come in the first year. They'd bear the second year, and about the fourth year, that area would turn from blueberries into blackberries. And then within another couple of years, then it started getting, you know, overstoried by trees, and it went back to forest. So you had this kind of patchwork quilt idea, and I think even in our backyards, in your nut, your fruit trees, you need to think about patchwork things. For example, this year we're having a fantastic grape crop. Our grapes are as good as they've ever been, even though we didn't get any apples, and it doesn't look like we got any pawpaws. You know, most of the time, everything doesn't go down at once, and so this diversity deal, spreading your risks, this is all part of it. And the fact is, it takes time. It takes time to build up those things to do that. You know, we're early on this this rediscovering and reapplication of some of this you know, backyard dependency. And there's been a lot of information lost. There's been a lot of genetic adaptability lost in the centralization of seed stock, centralization of nursery stock, and you know, as thousands and thousands of us begin, you know, doing exactly what you've done, you know, there, you know, we will find our Massachusetts cultivars, even, you know, for whatever your county is, those cultivars we will rediscover those things, because that's exactly the kind of food system that has sustained civilizations throughout history.
I agree. You know, my grapes are doing great this year. They also got zipped by the frost because they forced early. But grapes apparently like punishment, so they're just having a great year this year.
Yeah, grapes are probably one of the most resilient things you can do. And then, of course, some of the other things you can micromanage. I mean, like, for example, strawberries. You know, you can lay Remay on them easily and help a lot. Remay is a, you know, floating row cover, or even a light dusting of straw. You know, one of the things that we've done is we have a floating garden in the pond. We built a pond here for irrigation for the garden, so that, you know, if it got dry, we could always irrigate. And so, you know, that cost us a couple thousand dollars, but now we've got, you know, 500,000 gallons of water sitting there, you know, 40 yards from the back door of the house that we can, you know, we can use for irrigation. And it's soft water. It's not aquifer water. It's not cold well water. It's truly our water, because it fell on our place. We captured it from our place, and we're gradually letting it go downstream and using those raindrops multiple times on their way to the ocean. Anyway, we actually have a floating garden out there on 6-inch PVC pipe, a raft that we fill up with compost and plant on, and the water acts as a heat sink to control, to make ambient temperature better, and it just works beautifully. You know, solariums on the site. We have a solarium on the house. This is like a greenhouse on the southern exposure of the house. You know, every single house, you know, above Alabama and probably southern Georgia should have a solarium on the southern side of it. You can heat your house with it in the winter. And while you're heating your house, you can grow all your mesclun mix and broccoli and carrots and beets and, you know, cool season stuff in there all winter. And that's the kind of resiliency I'm talking about. You know, living roofs. I mean, hook your exercise bicycle up to a pump, you know, collect your roof runoff in a cistern, hook your exercise bike up to the pump, pump the water up onto the roof, and the roof, you know, has vermiculite and compost up there, and you're growing squash and cucumbers, you know, cascading down. You can pick your plants by opening the second floor windows. I mean, this is being done. It can be done. And all it takes is for us to, you know, to want to participate. You know, our weak link is not lack of money, lack of resources, lack of knowledge. Our weak link is constipation of imagination.
I love these ideas. So, first, what's growing in that floating garden?
Well, the first thing we grew in it was broccoli this spring, and it was completely bug-free. No sprays, no nothing, completely bug-free. The stuff that was growing 20 feet away in the garden, was we really had a lot of trouble with bugs. But the stuff in the floating garden on the pond, the bugs couldn't get there because they, you know, as they tried to get there, the fish would eat them, you know, from the pond. So, and I think right now we have a bunch of squash, a bunch of like you know, zucchini and crookneck squash in there right now. But yeah, I mean, we need to be designing our homesteads and our yards with microclimates in mind. For example, we've got these hoop houses that we put the chickens in the wintertime. And they of course they're on a southern slope, kind of, you know, stair stepped in or terraced in, and so instead of just having a bunch of, you know, steep little spots with, you know, lawn that we have to mow, well, we got a bunch of concrete blocks and we built a terrace to take advantage of the moisture coming off the hoop house, okay. Mm-hmm. And of course it faces south. The concrete blocks act as a heat sink. And so we can grow fig trees. We have fig trees growing in little enclaves surrounded by concrete blocks as a heat sink out from this southern exposed terrace that collects the extra rain coming off of the hoop houses. You know, this is real ecology. Mm-hmm. You know, not just, you know, walking away from it and, oh, you know, please don't let me touch it. You know, like it's some sort of a, you know, a sacred idol that, you know, that you can't touch or anything. Rather, this is actually, you know, the ecstasy, the sheer ecstasy of coming in as a team player, as a co-laborer in this ecology, and playing ball with it. You know, that's what I'm talking about.
You're talking about being a participant in the flow of creation rather than a bystander or an observer of it.
Exactly, exactly, and assuming. That whatever is there in nature is A, static, unchangeable, and B, best left alone. You know, anyone who studies ecology knows neither one of those is the case. I mean, look at the fires out in, you know, from Yellowstone to, you know, Colorado and all this stuff. These fires are a direct result of a non-participatory ecology. If you went in there and cut the dead and down trees, and if you went in there and did, you know, mob stocking, herbivorous, solar conversion, lignified sequestration, fertilization, grazing on these areas, there wouldn't be the load, the biomass load to burn and catch fire. And so, you know, this whole abandonment notion actually carries a huge cost. Now, I'm not interested in pillaging it or raping it. Okay, there's a lot of wiggle room between abandonment and raping.
Well, when you're doing nothing, you're still doing something. It's just not very much controlled or directed.
That's true. And nature's doing something too. And nature's doing something. You know, trees grow and die, and they fall over. And you can either use them for lumber, or you can let their carbon dioxide just go off in the atmosphere in decay. And create a fuel source for the fire coming through and send more carbon dioxide up in the atmosphere. Wouldn't it be a lot better to go ahead and mill that lumber into boards and lock it up into buildings that would lock it up and get that fuel out of those areas. You know, that's critical. And you know, I know that cattle have done a lot of damage, but you know, judicious grazing of cattle, now using electric fence technology and you know, the water delivery systems that we have, you know, we can actually build soil way, way faster with electric fences and delivered pipe water and cows than the buffalo and the wolves and the Native Americans and fire built soil 500 years ago.
I love that message, and I want to turn now and tap your position as ambassador, as an emissary of sorts. So you're on the road quite a bit. You give talks. You meet people. What's the good news? What can you tell us about increasing awareness of the issues that are outlined in your book, Folks, This Ain't Normal, and what sorts of actions are people taking that make you smile?
Well, I'll tell you about a couple places I've been, and these are pretty divergent. One is a guy, and I wrote about this in the book, Colin Cease in Australia. He's developed a system called pasture cropping, and if you're, one of the big problems with crops, with annuals, grains and things, is the tillage problem. That's a big problem. And so, of course, in our country, we've developed the no-till approach, which substitutes herbicides for the plow. And, you know, I don't want to get into that debate right now. But what I do want to make people aware of is what this pasture cropping idea has done, and it is taking off even across the world. And what it does is it combines livestock, very tightly managed grazed livestock, with a minimum disturbance system. So here's how it works. The grass grows up, you graze it off. And then instead of waiting until the grass, returns to its whatever physiological expression, its full growth, you come in on purpose and graze it too early. Again, this is where you're moving, a mob of animals every day in a very tight, controlled paddock situation. And you graze it too early and actually, on purpose, weaken the grass. Then you go in with a very light shoe. It's almost like a lawn aerator with a seed box attached. And you go in there and you minimally disturb little grooves. You lay in seed, and because the grass, the forage, the perennial, has been set back, weakened a little bit by the quick regraze, it gives time for the annual to germinate and sprout and get up ahead of it. And so imagine you've got timothy or rye or barley or even corn up 7 or 8 inches ahead of the grass. Well, as the annual builds up its head of steam, it starts to shade out the grass, which helps to retard the forage, the perennial that's underneath it. The annual goes ahead and makes its seed, and it gets combined off. And as that annual gets combined off, the seed gets harvested off. By that time, the plant, of course, has turned brown and started to desiccate, which opens up the canopy to let the light get back to the perennial. And so, by the time the seed head gets combined, you've got a nice 12-inch sward of pasture of perennials already ready to graze under the crop. And so not only do you get your grain crop, but you also get your grazing as well. And there's no herbicide usage. There's nothing. All you're doing is you're strategically using high-tech electric fencing, extremely beneficent management on that landscape to use animals as a tool to prep the seed bed, create the crop, get it in, get it out without any fertilizer, because the perennial fertilizes the annual, and amazingly, the production per acre on the seed on the annual crop is exactly the same as it is on a chemically fertilized, herbicided, pesticided, conventionally grown crop. It is really, really astounding. The only drawback is, of course, that you can't do this every year. You can only do this once in 5 years, because it takes 4 years in between for the perennial to build the soil energy that was expended in that grain crop. That's how soil debilitating grain crops are, and so you only do it once in 5 years. But if you quit feeding herbivores grain, which cows aren't supposed to eat grain, if you integrate the rest of the food system so that pigs eat whey from cheese making, chickens eat kitchen scraps the way they've historically done. So that you drop your grain requirement to just a tiny percentage of what's currently grown, you know, maybe, let's just say, you know, 20 or 30%, suddenly then you can produce all the grain needed in the world without any tillage, without any herbicide, without any without any petroleum fossil fuel fertilizer, and it's just a marvelous system. It leaves you speechless when you see how simply elegant it is. And so that's a very exciting thing. I've been there, I've seen it, I've talked to the man, and it is nothing short of astounding.
So this is pasture 5 years out of five, but in one of those years you can do a grain crop on it as well. Is that right?
That is correct. You got it. You got it exactly. And it's called, if anybody wants to Google it or whatever, it's called pasture cropping.
Pasture cropping.
Pasture cropping, yes. It's quite amazing.
And this will work at scale?
Yes. Yeah, this Colin's doing it, you know, in 300-acre fields. Yeah, absolutely.
Wow.
Yeah, all this scale.
Wow. And so when you go out and talk now, are you also seeing that, are people becoming more aware? I know there's been a huge food movement. There's slow food, there's slow money, there's a lot of local investing, there's a lot of anxiety around the global economy, so people are starting to focus, rightly, I think, more on their own backyards a little bit. As you go out there, are you finding, how would you measure more receptivity? Either you're seeing different sorts of people in the audience is a larger, we're seeing the age ranges of the interested folks change. What's going on?
All of the above. I think, for sure, what's happening to me as a, you know, I do a lot of traveling and speaking, and what's happening for me is I see a tremendous additional penetration where I'm doing a lot more, you know, college campus speaking. I'm doing, you know, economic development, chamber of commerce type, goodness, you know, Hyatt hotels. I mean, just you know, everything from corporate to just, you know, a local group, edible landscape magazines, you know, they might host a deal, schools. There's just a tremendous amount of stuff going on. And I call it a local food tsunami, and I'm riding the wave, and it's really fun to have been the ugly stepchild all my life and suddenly wake up one morning and I'm chic. I call it my Cinderella experience.
Well, I have a smaller experience of that, but I have the same experience. There was a moment in my life where I was saying things that were deeply unpopular, involved this thing called a housing bubble, years before it was a fashionable thing to talk about. But there is something in the air, and I really want to, first, thank you so much for your time today. I'm absolutely going to encourage everyone to read Folks, This Ain't Normal. I'm sure you can find it everywhere. I know that you can also follow Joel's writing and activities at the Polyface Farm page on Facebook. Joel, where else?
Well, that's probably the most comprehensive place, the Polyface Farms. We have a web page, and you can follow. You can see where I'll be if you want to come and hear me yak, do my dog and pony show.
Mm-hmm.
My schedule is on the website polyfacefarms.com, and just Google Polyface Farms, and then the schedule will come up. If you want to see pictures of what we're doing, if you want to see my latest whatever writings or things like that, we try to keep it current and posted there as well. But there really is a lot going on. It is a busy time for the local food movement, and we need to be busy because there's a tremendous amount of pushback from the industry and the entrenched food system that is not happy losing market share to people like us. And losing people to their dependency on Velveeta cheese and Coca-Cola, and so that's why voting with your food dollar, whether it's to find your farmer, grow your own garden, or go down to the farmer's market or to the roadside stand or whatever, any of these things, the thing is we need to just kick the supermarket addiction, treat it like a bad habit. And get in our kitchens. The number one thing you can do is get in your kitchen and cook from scratch, because that takes the dollar away from all the food processors and all that distribution food processing network that is all devoted to taking the life out of food and making sure food won't perish or won't rot, extending the shelf life. The longer the shelf life is on food, the less nutritious it is. So redevelop your larder. Enjoy culinary, domestic, arts, and begin one bite at a time extricating yourself from the agenda of people that if you knew what they actually believed, it would curl your hair.
Oh, I know. Apparently, there are fewer laws and penalties governing deep well injection of hazardous chemicals than there are for selling raw milk, say.
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely. You know, and the fact that we have given over to the government, which thinks the safety of our food, I mean, we're talking about people who think it's much safer to feed your kids Twinkies, Cocoa Puffs, and Mountain Dew than raw milk, compost-grown tomatoes, and pastured poultry. You know, this is just, it's unprecedented in the history of the world, and we are a culture of guinea pigs. But nobody's got you by the throat, and to make the changes that we've described today do not take an act of Congress. They don't take a change in the legislature. They don't take a change in the tax law. What they take is individuals to make committed, participatory, convictional decisions and change the landscape of our culture.
Oh, there it is. I have goosebumps. I really do. That is exactly the right message. I love it. And I'm certainly voting with my own dollars, and I do it not just because I want to get back at a system. I do it because it's healthier. It feels good. I'm supporting these wonderful, bright, shiny young kids who are coming up behind me who are interested in farming. I see the land getting improved. All of these things are just intuitively are right. They're intellectually right. Spiritually, they feel right. Everything feels good about this. So fight the marketing, I guess.
Yeah, that's right. You got it. What's there not to love? The only people that'll be out will be the bureaucrats and the Monsantos.
Couldn't happen to a nicer crowd. So I hope
that's
they find
right.
good jobs, whatever they do next. That would be.
Oh, they will. They will. I mean, this absolutely creates a much more dynamic, culture, a much more fun place to live. Believe me.
Oh, fantastic! Well, thank you again so much for your time. As always, this has been uplifting and illuminating. So, mission accomplished.
Thank you, Chris, and blessings on all your efforts. Take care.
All right. Thank you, and goodbye.